friends. Welcome back to yet another episode of What Page Are You On? It me, Bethany Rutter, and I'm here with my good friend and business partner.
It me, Alice Slater.
It you. I'm also joined in the room by naughty little Paddington, but he is in chill mode now, so I'm hoping that he won't cause too many naughty problems, like trying to eat my headphone cable. So yeah, let's dive right in. What are you reading right now, my friend?
Well, I've only been reading the subject of today's episode. I spent a whole weekend in it, fully absorbed, so I'm going to say no more. Have you read anything else?
I am currently reading, with my eyeballs, I'm reading Idol by Louise O'Neill, which I said I was going to read on the episode where we went through our TBR piles. And I'm true to my word. I'm loving it. I started reading it yesterday in the sunshine and it is so juicy already. I love it. I'm so excited to read more.
Do you think I would like it?
I think maybe you would like it. I will continue to read and I will report back, but I really think it could be one that you would enjoy. It's definitely like, you know, it's fun and juicy, but also quite dark. So
exactly,
could be one.
My cup of tea.
Exactly. Could be one for Alice later. And then with my ear holes, I've discovered on Audible, there's, you know, like how there's like for Kindle, there's Kindle Unlimited or whatever, where you get free stuff. Like you can read stuff for free. There is also that on Audible.
Have you not been on that?
I've been on it, but I never, it's only recently that I've started actually seeing stuff that I would want to listen to. In general, I was only seeing stuff that I was like, like I don't really want to listen to Derren Brown's Boot Camp for Life, you know.
Okay, that's wild, but fine. We'll have different taste.
How dare I? But then they've got a few Harlan Cobens on there, and I thought it would be fun to listen to Tell No One on audiobook, and that is what I'm listening to, and I'm having a great time.
Very fun. Yeah, I feel like they have some good stuff on.
Maybe
Audible
I need
Unlimited.
To do a proper deep dive or ask people for their recommendations. Because, yeah, for a while I was only seeing kind of like stuff that I'm not that bothered about. Like, I don't want to listen to The Midnight Library by Matt Haig.
Obviously not, because you don't hate yourself.
Yeah.
But the one thing I found with it is that, as with many of the Amazon built-in
free things,
like free content, it's just really difficult to browse. They're not interested in pushing it. And it can be difficult to just keep up with what's new and what's gone and what's, what's the sitch.
I hear you. So yeah, that's what I'm listening to and I'm having a great time. Shall we dive right in?
Let's dive right in. So long-time listeners of the pod may be aware that when we first started recording, a certain book, a specific book of a series, ended up being mentioned in every single episode. Now, additionally, we have done over recent months, we've covered a couple of like blockbuster bestsellers, which this book happens to be. But we've decided to start from the beginning and go with book one. And if we enjoy it, we might do book two as well. Bethany, would you like to do the honours and announce what we're discussing?
So today we are talking about Red Dragon by Thomas Harris. Alice, you are the nutsheller of this relationship. Shall we nutshell the book for our friends listening at home?
Yes, let's. First of all, I'm just going to quickly take off my bracelets.
Good girl.
Okay, so Red Dragon, in a nutshell, is the first book in the Hannibal Lecter series, is what I'll call it. So it's the novel that introduces Hannibal Lecter. But much like Silence of the Lambs, Hannibal Lecter is not a main character. He's a bit part. Red Dragon is about a serial killer who's known as the Tooth Fairy. He's being tracked by an investigator called Will Graham, who is out of the game. He's a retired cop after a run-in with Hannibal Lecter. The thing is, now, Will Graham is an empath, right? So he has a very unique ability to kind of get into the heads of serial killers and uncover unlikely, unusual connections that can help snag them. So the primary investigator on this case pulls him out of retirement and gets him involved. Had you read this book before, Bert?
I had not read this book. I had a few years ago watched Manhunter, but I had not read the book ever. So I was very excited to read it. Had you read
it before?
Tell
me about your reading. Oh yeah, so this is my second reading of Red Dragon. I think I've read Silence of the Lambs twice already. I'm a big fan, even though ordinarily I really don't like stuff from the perspective of cops. I don't like procedurals. And this book isn't without its flaws, But I just think Thomas Harris has such a compelling style, and his pacing is just sublime. And I just can't put it down. I can't look away.
Agree. So I loved this. As we know, Silence of the Lambs, one of my true faves, both the book and the film, love them. But yeah, I had never really engaged with Red Dragon. I don't know why. I think maybe because it wasn't Silence of the Lambs. I was just like, eh, you know, I know the thing that I like, and it's Silence of the Lambs. So I won't engage with Red Dragon. But I was wrong. The book is so good. And you're right. Thomas Harris is a very special boy, isn't he? I just find it so kind of compulsively readable that he writes with this like real clarity, but also real kind of art. It's so easy to follow. I'm never confused about what's happening, but I'm frequently delighted.
And also, I feel like the thing that I thought I liked about Silence of the Lambs, well, the thing that I do like about Silence of the Lambs is Clarice Starling and her relationship to Hannibal Lecter and that really horrible, weird mind game kind of cat and mouse situation they end up in. So that's also why I think I was not as interested in Red Dragon for quite a long time, because I was just like, well, it's all men. So it's all men and it's a procedural, like there's not going to be anything there for me. But the pacing, man, the pacing, it's just from the very first page, it's intriguing. I'm frightened. I find it genuinely quite unnerving. Okay. I felt like it still has quite a lot of parallels with Silence of the Lambs. You can see how Silence of the Lambs is essentially the same thing again, but just with like, instead of Will Graham, we have Clarice Starling. And instead of the Tooth Fairy, we have Buffalo Bill. But otherwise, it's a very similar vibe and energy.
Structurally very similar, yeah.
Yeah, which the rest of the books in the series don't follow at all. And I don't like them as much.
Yeah, I was going to say, maybe that's what makes them less successful. Let's deal with the thing that I suspect you are also thinking of when you're talking about the book's shortcomings up front. So my big issue with reading this book is, as with Silence of the Lambs, there is a lot of discomfort around the identity of the killer. In Silence of the Lambs, it's to do with, are they or are they not transgender? In Red Dragon, it's more to do with facial disfigurement, and that is kind of uncomfortable to read. So is that what you were thinking?
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like it's obviously quite ableist, even though I think a lot of work has gone into creating a background beyond the way that he looks. And in fact, the killer, the serial killer, is actually described as being attractive. Like, he is born with a cleft palate in a time when surgeries were quite new, and he was bullied a lot in his childhood and rejected a lot by his family because of the way that he looked. In fact, he was, you know, his mother put him up for adoption based on his appearance. And it's quite a shock when you realize 3/4 of the way through the book that he did actually end up having surgery, like reconstructive surgery on his mouth, and that he no longer actually has like an unusual appearance. He doesn't actually have any kind of disfigurement. It's just that psychological impact of his childhood never left him, which I thought was a kind of very odd and interesting way to kind of navigate that.
And it's the same with Silence of the Lambs, that all signs point to the serial killer being a trans woman, but Thomas Harris is very careful to be like, he's not a trans woman, he just thinks he is. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's often this kind of way of trying to deal with the potential for that to be problematic by sort of second-guessing it, which I still find a little bit dubious.
Yeah, because it's about impact, isn't it? Like, it's about impact. And ultimately, the kind of the modus operandi of the Tooth Fairy, like, he's very orally fixated. He has a very distinct bite mark, which kind of the backbone of the investigation is on. So the horror comes from his mouth. And with Buffalo Bill, obviously, the horror comes from the using women's skin, creating women's clothing. It's not directly because he is quote unquote cross-dressing, but it's not because of that. Like, it's still kind of focused on clothing and appearance. So even though he includes these like little get out of jail free card moments of like, ah, but it's not really this thing, it's this other thing, he's still focusing the horror on those aspects of these people anyway.
Yeah, that whether it's relevant to them or not, that is still, they're still kind of two quite stigmatized or marginalized things that we would do well to not associate with horror or criminality.
Agreed. Especially as I feel like in Red Dragon, I don't want to keep talking about Silence of the Lambs because we may end up deep diving into that book as well. But it's also not necessary. I don't feel like that aspect of the killer is actually necessary. Like, his childhood is abusive in lots of different ways, and he's a very traumatized child. You could still have that relationship, that very Norman Bates relationship to his grandmother. That could all still be there without having the whole cleft palate aspect.
Agree.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. But aside from that, I loved Red Dragon. I loved it. I listened to it on audiobook and I had a whale of a time. I found it juicy and exciting and scary and just weird and captivating.
And it certainly is a book that lots of people have reacted to in the same way. It sold 50 million copies as of 2019. I've done quite sloppy half-assed research, but still 50 million copies. And you know, like, and it launched Hannibal Lecter. Tell me, how did you feel about meeting Hannibal the Cannibal for the first time in this setting?
Fascinating, because I didn't realize that essentially the relationship to Hannibal is the same. So, because previously my primary relationship has been with Silence of the Lambs, where he is already a kind of pre-existing character, I assumed that in a previous book, i.e. Red Dragon, that would have been the sort of, I don't know,
the origin story.
The origin story, yeah. And then to find out that even in Red Dragon, he is this pre-existing bogeyman kind of thing, that we get told about the backstory, how he has encountered Will Graham, what his, you know, kind of psychology is. But it isn't actually his story. That we don't have the first time we meet him isn't actually seeing what happened between him and Will Graham, that's sort of left for the future in terms of Thomas Harris's oeuvre. So I thought that was really interesting, and it was not what I was expecting.
But also, I don't think that he does ever really tell that story properly, because the books go from Red Dragon to Silence of the Lambs, where both of which Hannibal Lecter is incarcerated. And then the book Hannibal is still in the same timeline. It's present day with Hannibal Lecter out and about. And then he jumps right back to Hannibal Rising, which is all about his childhood. I don't think it covers his adult life at all.
Interesting. Yeah, because obviously I haven't engaged with the series beyond these two books. So I did not know that was a thing. So yeah, very interesting.
Yeah, I love this description of Will Graham when the first time he's kind of interviewing Lecter in the Red Dragon timeline. He describes him as looking at him almost to the back of his skull. And the quote that I really loved was, "His attention was like a fly walking around in there." It's so horrible. Like, Lecter moves with such gentle precision. Like, he's so kind of calculating and intelligent. And elegant, yeah, and ever-present. Nothing gets past him. And there's something so satisfying about the way that Lecter manages to get hold of some key information about Will Graham that he passes on to the Red Dragon, to the Tooth Fairy, to the serial killer. It all happens in such an elegant way. For those, I assume, if you're listening to this episode, I assume that you've already read the book. So to remind you, it's a moment where he pretends... He like does a series of phone calls where he pretends that he's supposed to know someone's name. He doesn't want to be rude, that he's forgotten the secretary's name. He doesn't want to get her into trouble. Like, it's all very elegant, and he's just so fucking manipulative that the person on the other end of the line never stops to question him. And I will say, so you've seen Manhunter, but not Red Dragon.
Yes, so
yeah,
I feel
like Brian Cox's performance in that scene in particular is so fucking good.
You know what, mate? Like, I have no real interest in watching Red Dragon, but maybe I'll just watch it anyway.
I don't recall it being that great, but...
Well, yeah, that's my general understanding, is that it's not that great. But something I thought was quite interesting was I'd seen Manhunter a few years ago, as I said, and then I listened to Red Dragon, and while I was listening to it, when I was quite close to the end, I watched Manhunter. And having read the book, it really made me enjoy Manhunter a lot less, which is unfortunate, because I think it works quite well on its own, but then when you see everything that it doesn't do, it really, I think it also makes you appreciate how good the film of Silence of the Lambs is in terms of pure adaptation. But one of my fave bits of, basically my problem with the film Manhunter is that there are all of these kind of bits in the book that are really delightful and weird. And then in the film, they have had to sort of cut it down so much that they barely make sense or they barely figure. So one of my favourite bits of the book is, you know, when he takes Reba, his blind colleague, on this weird date to touch the sedated tiger.
Yeah. Which
is so good and so weird. And in the book, it's all explained and it makes perfect sense as to why he is able to take this colleague to see this tiger at the zoo while it's under sedation, because it's part of this cover story he's made up for why he needs this infrared equipment. Like, it's all very, I feel like Thomas Harris is very good at leaving no narrative stone unturned. He's a very rich writer, a very dense writer. And obviously this date occurs in the book after they have known each other for a while, whereas in the film, in Manhunter, this literally happens the first time they meet. He volunteers to take her home instead of a colleague. And on the way, he's like, I've got a surprise for you. And he takes her to the zoo. Like, there is no preamble to it at all. So it is just absolutely bizarre. So it made me really appreciate how good the book is.
Yeah, because that does explain why. I recalled when I was reading that scene, I remember thinking, why did I always find this confusing as to how he had access to a tiger?
Yeah, and it's which is a very reasonable question.
Yeah, and it's because I saw Manhunter first too. I watched Manhunter as a student and read the book. I think I ended up reading the book around the same time because I loved the film so much. And yeah, although I've definitely watched the movie since, and there's still lots of scenes that I think are brilliant. Like the In the Garden of Eden playing while she's like feeling her way around the house.
Yeah, amazing.
I'm remembering that. Yeah, brilliant. It's just like, it's so iconic. And I think Brian Cox is so fantastic as Hannibal Lecter, which, considering obviously Anthony Hopkins just truly owns that role, I think to watch another actor, obviously he was doing it first, but another actor embodying a very different kind of Lecter, but still completely vile and captivating and just brilliant to watch.
Agreed.
But then, yeah, then you would think that Red Dragon should be better. But I just don't recall liking it very much, although I couldn't tell you why. And I think I've seen it at least twice.
Yeah, it's not one that's sort of in the cultural memory as being good. The other thing I found really underdeveloped in Manhunter, and I loved in the book Red Dragon, is Freddie Lowndes. One of my favourite bits is when he does that. They're doing this really high-stakes sting on a phone booth that they believe that the killer is going to be communicating with them from. And basically they discover that it is this reporter from this gossip newspaper who is trying to get information out of them for his paper. And that is just so... I loved it. I was screaming. I was listening to it while I was eating a bun from Chinatown Bakery, and I was just high on life.
It is just such good plotting. Like, it's absolutely flawless. And his, at first, obviously, I'm just like, why the fuck is he doing that? But of course, it's not just that he wants information. He actually wants to be cut in, is his words. He uses the phrase cut me in because he wants to get exclusive insight so that he can then pitch a book. And like, it's just so corrupt and pathetic. And like, especially because they know the investigation has a very specific sense of urgency, because they know that this killer will strike again, and they know that he will strike at the next full moon. So they're on a clock, time's ticking. And like this massive diversion, it's such a massive waste of police time. It's you genuinely feel angry about it, like, and I love that kind of writing. I felt so emotionally invested in this. Yeah, well, fucking you're
like,
sting.
They're gonna make progress, something exciting is gonna happen, like, you know, it's probably not gonna be the conclusion because we're miles away from the end of the book, but like something's gonna happen, and then it's just this fucking clown. Yeah, I love it.
And then
it.
Of course the fate of Freddie Lowndes. Oh my god, it makes me feel so ill.
And that is really drawn out in the book. You get so much of him essentially being held captive by Francis Dalarhyde, Red Dragon, Tooth Fairy himself, and he's essentially tortured and suffers some real horrendous injuries before he is set on fire in a wheelchair and rolled down a slope, which...
But even the fact that this completely elaborate and horrendous murder, so many elements of it are essential to the plot.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, there's so many elements are essential to them eventually
being able
figuring
to understand
out who
yeah.
he is. Like, it just, it does, you mentioned earlier that he's, that Thomas Harris is like a narrative king. I can't remember what you said, but his work is just so full of those kinds of breadcrumbs that are so satisfying, because it's all about, you don't have to read the book that closely because he writes with such clarity that you remember
exactly.
everything. But everything comes back.
And you don't need them being pointed out. You like, he doesn't have to sort of very heavily go like, this is important. You know, like he sets Freddie Lowndes on fire in a wheelchair. And then it's by virtue of having this specific wheelchair that they are sort of able to deduce some things maybe about the killer. But it's not, it, in itself, setting Freddie Lowndes on fire and rolling him away in a wheelchair would stand alone as a thing that is visually exciting and something that makes sense. So
yeah.
it's not like it's intrinsic to solving the plot, but it also is. So yeah, I really miss that from the film because I just love that little bitch character so much.
Oh, so that scene isn't in Manhunter?
Only the scene with the wheelchair on fire.
Okay.
So that, you get the visual of that, but you don't really have any of the sense of, like, Freddy really believing that this is going to be his big break and he's going to make loads of money and he's going to get this book deal, and then he gets kidnapped and then he gets tortured and it becomes increasingly apparent to him that he is not going to be let go. So yeah, it's sort of, that's the thing, like, you get the sort of, you know, you get the blind woman touching the tiger, but you don't get why, like, you sort of don't get the rest of it. The thing that is in the book Red Dragon but is not in Manhunter, which is a really deranged scene, is when he goes to the Brooklyn Museum and eats the William Blake picture.
Yeah,
which
it's
is crazy.
A mad thing to do. And of course, it's such a high risk thing for him to do because obviously he knows that they will know that it was him. So it's kind of insane on multiple levels, but it's also so great. Like, it's such a weird, tense scene because you have no idea what the fuck he's planning on doing until, I think the line is like, he has the last bit in his mouth and you're like, oh, yes. He fucking ate it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's wild. And it's probably just too weird to do visually, you know, to do on film. I don't know. I think it would just be inherently almost like too comedic to.
I wish I could remember whether or not. I just wish I could remember whether or not it's in Red Dragon.
Yeah, alas, I cannot tell you. But yeah, I feel like I loved reading, well, having the book read to me on audio, but watching the film then made me really appreciate the bits that I had loved so much more because, you know.
I think it's interesting as well, right, that the Red Dragon kind of is centralized around William Blake, and it did kind of remind me of the Da Vinci Code, that like,
yes,
these like echoes of quote unquote highbrow culture threaded through like a kind of very commercial best-selling thriller. I don't know. Does that elevate it? Does that give the reader a sense of elevation that they're reading something more literary than they are? Is that not something that readers care about at all? I don't know. I think it's really interesting because I can't think of a thriller that I've read in the last decade that has had any kind of focal point in any kind of
culture. High art. Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, I know what you mean. Because that is the sort of origin of Red Dragon as a persona, is this William Blake drawing. Because the Tooth Fairy is a name given to him by the FBI or the police, but Red Dragon is his persona and comes from this William Blake thing. So, yeah, he's just got to eat it. He's got to eat it.
He's just got to... Sometimes you just need to eat a fucking painting. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
So something you just mentioning it a while ago reminded me, you know how we were discussing how there are sort of certain similarities structurally between Red Dragon and Silence of the Lambs, that it is in some ways just a sort of do-over of the same structure but with different elements.
Yeah.
And you mentioned the scene in the film where his colleague Reba is in the house, and it's kind of near the conclusion. And because
I know exactly
blind,
what you're going to say.
she is blind, so she's feeling her way around. And that is exactly the same as Clarice in the basement.
Yes!
Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah, so, I finished this book yesterday night. And when I was reading that scene, I was like, it's fucking, this is Clarice in the basement with the infrared goggles. It's the same thing.
Yeah. The best bit, in my opinion.
You know what though? Because this is the thing, right? That scene in Silence of the Lambs, particularly in the film, is one of the most frightening and tense pieces of cinema. Every time I watch it, I feel like I'm going to throw up. It hasn't worn off on me at all. And I love the fact, I think it's so brilliant that as a writer, he's managed to just regurgitate something he's actually done before, but it's
and still
so
make
different.
It so effective.
Yeah, because it's so different. And like, there's so many aspects are different that it's almost unrecognizable, but actually the core of it is the same. Ah!
Yeah.
Thomas Harris, coming, sly dog.
Yeah. Gal coming face to face with baddie, who has only just recently unmasked themselves, and she cannot get out. So yeah, I am so glad that I have read Red Dragon, because I really enjoyed it. Do we know how do people feel about the other books, A, in the Hannibal series, and B, outside of the Hannibal series, that Thomas Harris has written?
So within the Hannibal series, I know that Hannibal also popped off. Hannibal Rising was made into a movie, which I went to see at the cinema, and I was not a fan of it at all. It just didn't interest me. It feels more horror, but it's a prequel. Let's see, its initial printing was 1.5 million copies, but it had a mixed critical response. So obviously they expected big things from it. I'm sure it did sell incredibly well, but critically, mixed bag.
Yes.
And then he's released another one since then. He released a fifth book, and I was like, I'm not even going to bother. Let me just see what it was. Oh, okay. No, beg your pardon. I thought he'd released a fifth book in the Hannibal series, but he hasn't. What he released was something called Carrie Mora, which his first book in 44 years to not feature the iconic Hannibal Lecter.
Oh, yes. So this was the recent one that people didn't seem to really like.
Yeah. As far as I'm concerned, that completely disappeared immediately. I don't know anything about it. And the Wikipedia page, I am going to say right now, has a very long... very, very long plot description, which I'm not going to try and skim. So there's that. And then his debut was something called Black Sunday.
Never
heard
of it.
Which I also know nothing about. It's a thriller about terrorists planning to commit mass murder at the Super Bowl in New Orleans.
Okay. Well, you like a bit of New Orleans.
I do, but I'm not here for terrorist...
or Super Bowls.
Like, yeah, nothing about that speaks to me as much as... I really like Thomas Harris's work. I don't love it so much that I would go outside of my Hannibal Lecter comfort zone.
True. So basically what we're saying is that his next book should be the third version of whatever he is doing in Red Dragon and Silence of the Lambs, that he can just reproduce that one more time and he'll have a big hit on his hands.
Thing is, what I would like, and I'm 99% sure that Hannibal Rising doesn't cover this, because I think it ends before Hannibal is an adult. Anyway. Oh, yeah. It ends with him getting residency at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, Maryland, which is where he is when he gets up to his...
criminy tricks.
Sinful business. So, yeah, that's... I would like a book that picks up from there, please. That's what I want to read. I want to read Will Graham catching Hannibal. I mean, the thing is, I know that a lot of that story has been told in throughout the course of Red Dragon, Silence of the Lambs, and Hannibal. I think we have so many flashbacks that,
yeah,
and characters not much talking to fill in about. Yeah, but I can't remember the story. I don't know what happens. I can't remember who any of his victims were. Like, give me the good stuff.
True. I will say I did find Will Graham a slightly less compelling protagonist than Clarice, and I don't know exactly why, but I just, yeah, just care about him a little bit less.
I have a theory, because I don't think
he, like... Is it that I hate men?
It's as a known misandrist. So the thing is, right, is that Clarice Starling is almost, she's like an ingenue, right? And, but she has an incredible empathy. And like, that's why everything goes so badly for her, because she can't help but let Hannibal Lecter into her head. Will Graham is set up as an empath. Like, it is like the empath meme, you know? But also, he actually has, simultaneously, he's frightened to get into the head of serial killers. He's frightened by his capacity to get into their heads. But also, he has absolutely no empathy whatsoever. Like, there's this line, which I flagged the page because I wanted to bring it up. This is the other thing that I just don't like about this book. Listen to this. For a hard second, this is from like page 274, so about 3/4 of the way through. For a hard second, he remembered palm fronds rustling in the sea wind. He wanted very much to go home, knowing he would not, could not, until the dragon was dead. For Will Graham, justice is death. He has no capacity to imagine anything other than killing Red Dragon. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have any interest in an arrest or incarceration or any kind of psychological... any kind of psychological understanding or any kind of empathy for what has led this person to do these things. And I know it's understandable that investigating officers who see the aftermath of these horrendous crimes will end up losing some of that empathy, some of that humanity. It's not something that I like to read about in this way, you know, especially when the character is so constantly being set up as this empath.
Yeah, who can sort of that word is deeply with the mind of others. My other issue with Will Graham is I think I'm also just increasingly, maybe because I've been watching season one of 24. It's relevant, I promise. I think I'm just getting a bit less and less interested with these sort of male characters who work in like law adjacent professions, whose sort of prime way of I don't know how to explain this, but in both season one of 24 and in Red Dragon, a way that a baddie could lean on Will Graham / Jack Bauer is by hurting or threatening to hurt their wife and child. And I think I'm just less interested in that as a concept. Do you know what I mean? I don't know how to explain it, but if that is the sort of the primary way of
I completely
if those
agree,
are the stakes, and I'm less interested. Whereas Clarice, I'm like, you are interesting. You're like early in your career. You've got this kind of slightly traumatic childhood, weird upbringing. You're clearly very talented. You are one of the few women in your line of work. There's just sort of more going on there. Whereas Will Graham, I find not particularly compelling as a character beyond this very supernatural ability to commune with the mind of bad guys. But yeah, the way that he could be leaned on is because he's got this wife and this stepson and he loves them so much. You know, I don't know. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but especially because he really focuses, because not only does he get into the minds of serial killers, but the way that he does that is also by getting as close to the deceased family as possible, by reading their diaries, their letters, watching their home movies, that kind of thing. And he really focuses on one of the two dead mothers, Do you recall that? He's a very, like, he gets very focused on Mrs. Leeds because he sees his wife in her. And he almost gives no thought to the children, to the men who are also murdered by this serial killer. He's very focused on this one woman in a way that just feels very vapid.
Yeah,
is vapid the right word? It just feels like very shallow. It just feels like a very shallow thing, that the image that hurts him the most almost is realizing that this woman, when she gets a ladder in her tights, she cuts that leg off and then will pair it with another leg of an old laddered pair. And it's this very kind of thrifty thing that she does to save money. And it reminds him of his wife. And that really hurts him to his core. And I liked that moment because that's very human.
Mm-hmm.
But that seems to be it. That seems to be, it's just like, that becomes this very one note, almost like strange obsession with the fact that he couldn't save this one woman. And he doesn't really reflect much on the children or on this woman's husband. It's just very much this, like, archetypal dead woman as the stand-in for all women. And that, you know, that his kind of, his only real drive to catch the serial killer is to prevent other women from being murdered, even though the serial killer's whole vibe is killing off an entire family at a time.
Yes. Yeah.
Basically, right. Fuck you, Will Graham.
Yeah, he wasn't as annoying as he's also... I found him, maybe he was just read in quite a sympathetic way by the narrator, but I found him more enjoyable to spend time with in the audiobook than I did in the film.
Manhunter. Yeah, I guess I didn't actually, although I'm the kind of nitpicking things I dislike about the book, but I didn't actually dislike spending time with him. I just feel like he's very much a one note.
He's just
very
a much dude.
Like a, yeah, he's just like, he's just this dude. And like, he's basically no different to Jonathan Creek or Sherlock Holmes. Like, all he does is this whole, like, getting into the mind of serial killers. I feel like it's pushed to a more supernatural place in the TV show.
Yes,
whatever
yes,
the
yes.
fuck that's called. Yeah.
That was called Hannibal.
Right, yes. It's pushed to a more supernatural place there. In the book, it's more that, it's more of an obsessive place, and he doesn't like himself when he is in that obsessive place. It's not healthy for him, as it's not healthy for anyone, like, to spend that much time looking at crime scene images, to reflecting on the most violent aspects of, like, unusual contemporary violence anyway. But I didn't necessarily dislike spending time with him. He's just another borderline alcoholic, jaded ex-copper.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's
yeah.
quite a standard character.
Yeah, I agree. Whereas it does feel like Clarice is something slightly different. And, you know, there's been more of them since then, more characters in that mould, but I do really... And obviously, you know, in my brain, I've also got the phenomenal Jodie Foster performance to illuminate it.
That helps, doesn't it? Like, undeniably, when I read Clarice Starling, I'm seeing Jodie Foster. But I think that's almost just, like, kind of paramount to how, like, to what a fantastic character the source material was providing, you know? Like,
I agree.
I was just going to say, even though there may have been other characters that, like, follow in Clarice Starling's footsteps, I still feel like no one has quite compared to her.
Agree. So I was thinking, my big question is, do you think it would be possible to make a good film of Red Dragon, or do you think that the constraints of the book mean that it would always end up being, like, too long? I will give you my theory, which is what I have been thinking about since I watched Manhunter, which is, I watched Manhunter last weekend and I watched Silence of the Lambs this weekend. And obviously, Silence of the Lambs is such a good film. It is such a great film in every way. Incredible performances, just made so brilliantly. And I was like, would it be possible to do this for Red Dragon, or is it not possible? And that is why it hasn't happened. I think that because in Red Dragon, we see so much of the serial killer as a sort of parallel point of view, and there are so many long sections where you're just with him, I think that would make it harder to translate into film in an economic way. because you kind of have to have both in order for his psychology to make sense. Because that's my big problem with Manhunter, is that you don't really get enough of the serial killer to understand why he's doing it, why he's scary, what his story is. Whereas in the book, you get so much. Whereas in Silence of the Lambs, you do get a bit of stuff with Buffalo Bill, but because Hannibal is much more helpful in that book, he gives you a lot of the access to who Buffalo Bill is. So you get to have that in the contemporary investigation timeline, which in yeah. Red Dragon you cannot have. So I posit that it would not be possible to make a good film of Red Dragon, because it would always end up being like 4 hours long and would not get made.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really interesting point, because obviously Hannibal Lecter knew Buffalo Bill. So he knows who it is. He knows all along who it is. So he's very much just fucking around with Clarice Starling. He could have told her from the very beginning. Whereas obviously in Red Dragon, he doesn't know. He's the Hannibal Lecter and Francis, what's his name?
Francis Dolarhyde.
They're total strangers. So there's no, he has no, nothing beyond just his insights as a psychologist.
And also the communication that he gets from.
Very little, but yeah. But I guess the thing with Red Dragon is that it does have these very long flashback scenes in the middle that take you through Dolarhyde's childhood, which I think I personally found them quite dull. In my second reading, I found them quite dull. There wasn't really very much tension in those moments because we already know. We already know who he is. We know who the killer is. This like deep dive into everything that led up to him becoming the man that we're now reading about just didn't really interest me as much until the kind of later scenes with his grandmother, which are just... So I think in theory, you could, if you were prepared to include that, those flashbacks, but I just don't think they hold the narrative tension for it to be good, a good addition. It always makes sense to me that those flashbacks are cut out.
Yeah, who knows?
Something to ponder.
Much to consider. Well, I feel like we've done a lot of chat on Red Dragon.
Yeah, I have nothing more to say.
I've enjoyed this chat, and we will be back next week with a very fun little interview that we're very hyped about, which we've already done, so we can tell you that it's good. We don't have to speculate that it will be good. We know it's good. And we will see you next time.
See you next time. Bye.